In this lesson, we will study the fundamentals underlying images, look at popular image file formats, and we're also going to take a look at various image and video representations that use different color models. Some are based on human perception of color. We will look at the human perception of color in both quantitative and qualitative terms. We will emphasize on the quantitative aspect of human perception. We will look at the motivation behind the color models in use today and how they have been arrived at. We will also take them in the context of particular representations of video and audio. The sources for this lecture are from my own research notes, once again from Dr. Zinyan Lee's lecture notes and some helpful literature from Adobe. Before we delve into the details of images, their formats, and color and color models, let's take a look at some of the terminology that is used extensively in this particular domain. The first thing that comes to mind is a pixel. Pixel is short for a picture element, and it is the smallest unit of a digital image. Often, an image is determined or characterized by its resolution. The resolution of an image is the number of pixels in the image. Higher the resolution, it gives higher the quality. Unfortunately, there are several definitions or several ways to describe image resolution. One of the most common ways is to describe it by the width of the image and the ratio of the width and height of the image. So normally we would say this image resolution is 640 by 480, which is the width being 640 and the height being 480. Another way to talk about images is through aspect ratios. Though aspect ratios go farther than just images, often devices like monitors have aspect ratios, and the very common aspect ratio that is in tune with human perception is the aspect ratio of 3:4. Resolution of images have also been talked about in terms of dots per inch, or sometimes called pixels per inch. Obviously, just talking about the width by height doesn't really tell you what the physical size of an image is going to be, because you don't know how many pixels make up one inch. So dots per inch further qualifies that that term by saying that you have 72 dots per inch. That tells you how many dots make up a line, and then from that you can figure out what is the space between lines, consecutive lines. Because if you knew the aspect ratio, you knew what the dots per inch is, and you knew what the dimensions of the image are, you pretty much can ascertain what all the details about the distance between the lines, the distance between the columns, and the number of pixels in a given area. The other term we often encounter in graphics or images is a bitmap. A bitmap is a representation of a graphic or image in the same manner as it is stored in video memory. What we mean by that is what you see on your monitor is nothing but an exact image of what is in the video memory. In other words, the video memory of a screen would typically have values for each and every pixel. And when I say a bitmap, all we're really talking about is what is the value for each and every pixel that is stored in video memory. Often, we say bitmaps are represent the image itself, though eventually it gets corresponded to the video memory because that's where it's stored when it's displayed. The other term that comes to mind is bits per pixel. This contributes to the quality of the image. Bits per pixel typically tells us how much depth or how much quality you can have in each pixel. For example, if I have a monochrome image, which is just black and white, then what you have is just one bit per pixel, which doesn't give you a very high quality. Contrast this with something like a 24-bit image, which is another way of saying 24 bits per pixel image, and you would have a very high quality image. One of the problems with the image resolution definition is that people use aspect ratio and width and height, and there's confusion because width by height is very explicit. When I say 640 by 480, it's the width is 640 and the height is 480. The aspect ratio is exactly the opposite, because it says, when I say the aspect ratio is 3:4, that's lines is to columns. Lines are actually the number of rows, and columns are the number of columns, and usually lines represent the height, and columns represent the width. So there are two opposite ways of looking at the same thing, and that sometimes causes confusion. However, throughout this lesson and subsequent lessons, we will make explicitly clear when I say aspect ratio, it's always going to be lines is to columns, and when I say just resolution plainly, then I simply mean width by height. Let's take a few examples of resolutions. The most common thing that the simplest resolution that comes to mind is when we use bits per pixel of one bit for each pixel, which is monochrome. Each pixel is stored as a single bit of 0 or 1, and typically a 640 by 480 monochrome image would require 37.5 kilobytes of storage. Contrast this with a grayscale representation. A grayscale is one where we would assign a byte for each pixel, or 8 bits for each pixel, and so each pixel has a gray level, and the gray level can go anywhere from 0 to 255. Obviously, you have a wider array of grayness to choose from, and therefore the quality of the image is much higher. A 640 by 480 grayscale image obviously requires 8 times the space, and so you would have around 300 kilobytes of storage. And from the screen, you also see that the difference between the two figures is quite significant. By the way, this picture will be used quite often, and it happens to be used extensively in image processing, and it's referred to as LENA. Another way of looking at monochrome images is a concept called dithering. Dithering is, in terms of technology, or in terms of perception, it sits between monochrome and grayscale. If you imagine most newspapers, though you see pictures on the newspaper that look like they have a grayness in them, in reality they're actually nothing but black and white dots. Dithering is a way of giving you this illusion of grayness by combining patterns of black and white in such close proximity that they appear as gray. If you look closely at a newspaper photograph with maybe a magnifying lens, what you would notice is that at the finest level, you really have only black dots and white dots, are no ink. This close proximity of white and black produces this illusion of grayness. And this is what we call as dithering. In printing, dithering is usually called half-toning, and shades of gray are called half-tones. Note that dithering differs from grayscaling, because in grayscaling, each individual dot can have a different shade of gray, whereas in dithering, the dots are basically either black or white. It's just the proximity that gives you the illusion of grayness. Let's go one step further and take a look at what happens when you have more than one bit or more than a byte of space allocated for each pixel. In a 24-bit image, we would have each pixel being represented by 3 bytes. And as you are aware, these 3 bytes represent the red, green, and blue components of that pixel. We would say that a 24-bit image supports 256 by 256 by 256 possible colors, which is around 16 million colors. Because of the amount of space we use for each pixel, a 640 by 480 24-bit color image would require around 921 kilobytes of storage. That's almost a megabyte of storage. Many 24-bit color images, though, have a fourth byte, which is actually deceiving, because we say 24-bit and it's actually a 32-bit image, and the extra byte is often used for what we call as transparency information or special effects information. This is sometimes referred to as the alpha value of the pixel. To give you an example of what a special effect could be, we could, in addition to having the red, blue, and green components, if one were to edit the content of image by either removing parts of it or fading out parts of the image, one can do that by just changing the alpha values and keeping the RGB values intact. This allows for easy editing without losing the original content of the image, and also allows you to do special effects like eliminating pieces of the image, or even emphasizing some and at the expense of others. The other possibility is 8-bit images like what GIF uses, but they use a interesting technique whereby you do not sacrifice the quality of the image. The idea is that you still give 1 byte for each pixel, which means that you support 256 out of a possible 16 million colors, which is pretty much the entire set of colors one can do using 24 bits. But what you do is use a concept called a lookup table. A lookup table is, for an 8-bit image, is a table with 256 entries, where each entry is a 24-bit value that represents a particular color. So the idea here is that when most images don't have all the possible colors that you can possibly encounter. So what we do is, if there are some colors that are prominent or common, we just store these colors as 24-bit values in the table and index them with one of 256 possible indices. By doing so, we can achieve a significantly high quality, as we will see in the next screen. Using again a 8-bit image like GIF, one can achieve a space requirement for a 640 by 480 image around 307.2 kilobytes of storage. As you would notice, we said that a 640 by 480 8-bit image in the previous screen took up around 300 kilobytes, but now we say that it takes up around 307.2 kilobytes. Well, the 7.2 extra kilobytes have come up from the fact that you have to store a lookup table along with the image, because that particular index of colors is specific to this image, and it's also called the palette for this image. As I just mentioned, though GIF-like formats only use 8 bits per color, 8 bits of color for each pixel, what we see is that they can achieve significant quality almost comparable to a 24-bit image. You see in the screen ahead of you a 24-bit color image, which is a JPEG color image, which takes up around 60 kilobytes of storage. a different version of the same image, which is an 8-bit color GIF image, which takes up 30 kilobytes. And one can notice that they look pretty similar. In order to get to know the differences, one has to really pay close attention to see that there are certain artifacts that are kind of blurred in the case of the 8-bit color image. But for a majority of people, or for majority of purposes, one would say that the two look almost equivalent. There have been several formats in which images have been represented. As a matter of fact, the number of formats makes it very complicated to exchange images between various systems. Today we find that the most popular formats are the GIF, or as the people who came up with this would emphasize that it's actually GIF and not GIF. It stands for Graphics Interchange Format, and it was devised by the people at Unisys Corporation, formerly part of CompuServe. And this format was initially conceived for exchanging images over phone lines. That explains why they were particular about the bandwidth. That is, that they wanted to limit the amount of space that each pixel takes up. The other thing that they did is also they used a compression mechanism, which we're going to study in the later part of the course, called the Limpel-Ziv-Welch algorithm. This is where the controversy with this format comes about. The fact that this compression algorithm has been patented limits the use of the GIF format in the sense that people who would want to use this are skeptical that they would be charged a fee for having to use a patented format. Again, it supports an 8-bit color images using lookup tables, and it also supports a concept called interlacing. Interlacing is an idea that is popular with television monitors, where we do not display all the lines in the perfect order. That is, we don't display the top line and then the next line and the next line and the next line in strict order, but we display the first line and skip and display the second line maybe, or the fourth line and the eighth line, and then we go back and fill in the gaps that have been left out. And that's interlacing. GIF supports this this property. There's an extension of GIF, which is a GIF 89A, which also supports simple animation. Perhaps the more popular version of our format for graphics images is JPEG, simply because it's an open standard that has been arrived at by a group of experts called the JPEG, or the Joint Photographics Experts Group. The power of this format, or the strength of this format, comes from the fact that it uses a compression mechanism, and the compression mechanism is not based on text compression, but it is sensitive to the human perception of images. That is, the compression mechanism takes into account how humans perceive images and how they react to various colors and the intensities of light. It is a lossy compression in the sense that you do lose certain information in the process of compressing the file. However, the loss, it tends to be unnoticeable for the human eye. The other aspect of JPEG that makes it very appealing is the fact that the loss involved in compression can be controlled by the user. That is, one can determine, as if by using a slider, one can determine what one is willing to sacrifice in terms of the quality in order to get compression. So if you are connecting through a low bandwidth, you would probably want a reasonable quality, provided you can get it in a in good amount of time. So you would favor compression and sacrifice quality. If you had a high bandwidth connection, then you would not be worried about compression. Then you would be able to get a high quality and not worry about compression. JPEG has some advanced modes that allow interlacing and something else called progressive scanning. However, these advanced modes happen to be optional and therefore do not constitute the baseline JPEG. Continuing with some of the formats, by the way, the formats we've been looking at so far, both GIF and JPEG, are system-independent formats. That is, they don't require anything from the operating system or the hardware in order to be displayed. They're independent of the hardware platform and the operating system. TIFF, which is a popular format that has been used or that has been developed by the Aldus Corporation, has been adapted extensively and promoted by Microsoft. TIFF stands for Tagged Image File Format and stores many different types of images. And that is, JPEG is known to store mostly RGB images, whereas GIF is known to store 8-bit images. TIFF can store monochrome images, grayscale images, 8-bit images, and 24-bit RGB images. The flexibility of TIFF comes from the fact that originally it was conceived as not to have any compression, and so they had a lot more flexibility with it. However, some of the newer versions of TIFF have a tag called a JPEG tag in them, which allows them to use JPEG compression. TIFF does not provide any major advantages over JPEG and is not as user controllable, and it appears to be declining in popularity. Other system independent formats going beyond images are for graphics involving animations, and popular formats that come to mind are the FLC format, which is the main animation or moving picture file format created by Animation Pro. FLI is another version that's similar to FLC, and GL is perhaps one of the most highest quality graphics animation format. However, it takes up extremely large amounts of space, and it's generally used only for production quality graphics. The other aspect of images comes from using typesetting languages like PostScript and PDF. The difference between the formats like GIF, JPEG, TIFF, and the PostScript or PDF is that within PDF, you don't really represent the image in its native form. You would represent it as vectors, as comprising of vectors. In some cases, when you cannot represent it by a vector, you probably have a bitmapped image. It is used in several popular graphics programs like Illustrator and Freehand. And the point to remember about these formats is that they don't provide any compression and the files are very large. Of course, one can always take a PostScript file and do text compression on it because it tends to be entirely a typesetting language, which is all text. So it is possible to get some compression, but it's not a compression that's sensitive to the quality or content of the image. It's only taking advantage of repetition of textual content within the format. While we are at the in the discussion of formats, let's take a look at a couple of system dependent formats. The most popular ones that come to mind are the BMP format on Windows, the XBM format on X Windows, and the paint or picked formats that have been popularized by on the Mac operating system. Obviously, the fact that we are citing each of these formats in the context of a particular platform or particular operating system should make it clear that these are system-dependent formats. A system-dependent format like bitmap is BMP is capable of storing 24-bit bitmap images, and it's in the context of Microsoft's software, it's used extensively in PC Paintbrush and other programs. On the other hand, Paint and Pict are used primarily on Mac. Paint was originally used in the Mac Paint program initially only for 1-bit monochrome images, which was later extended in some sense, and also with more power in terms of drawing using vectors in Mac Draw using the Pict format. The format that's very popular on X Windows, which is XBM, is typically used for a wide range of things, starting from representing icons, small icons, to large screens and even backgrounds on X Windows. It is a primary graphics format that is used. It supports 24-bit color, and the advantage is that there are several public domain editors that let you build XBM formatted images. Popular ones that come to mind are XV. More recently, there's a software called Magic Image Magic that does a better job of than XV. While several formats have emerged over the years, filling in requirements of various systems, in the case of system-dependent formats, and filling in requirements of for exchanging between machines with system-independent formats. Today, we look forward and see that one of the most promising image formats is the portable network graphics format, and the primary appeal of such a format is that it has been agreed upon by a group of experts, and therefore it will not be a proprietary format. And it's been designed to replace older and simpler formats like GIF, and to some extent some complex formats like TIFF. Let's take a look at what are the primary advantages of PNG over, for example, GIF. PNG provides alpha channels, which, as we talked about, alpha component is just the extra byte that we have for each pixel that allows us to represent variable transparency. Alpha channels or alpha components are sometimes also called mask channel, and it's simply a way to associate variable transparency with an image. PNG also uses another important feature called gamma correction. One of the problems with the GIF format and formats similar to GIF is that they tend to look different. A GIF image tends to look different on different screens. It has a lot to do with the color lookup table and the interpretation of the color lookup table that is done on that particular architecture or that particular machine. One of the things that PNG does is it uses this technique called gamma correction, which normalizes the information content so that it's independent of the platform. That is, it looks the same, it has the same appearance irrespective of which machine you're displaying it on. The other feature that is perhaps more appealing in today's web world is the fact that PNG uses two-dimensional interlacing as opposed to GIF, which uses one-dimensional interlacing. You see the difference very clearly from the link that I've provided you. Just to summarize what the difference is, the two-dimensional interlacing used in PNG does not render the image faster than GIF. That is, it doesn't necessarily mean that because it uses two-dimensional interlacing, it's going to display the image any faster than one-dimensional interlacing. What it really does is PNG renders a small fraction of the total image first and slowly refines the image in subsequent passes until the entire image is rendered. Think about it as if you were displaying the first 2 pixel content of each image, and then you are subsequently representing more pixels and refining the quality of the image, as opposed to GIF, where the interlacing involves rendering entire lines and then skipping some lines and then rendering a line like the 8th line and the 16th line and so on, and then you'd go back and you render the lines you missed on this pass, and then again you'd go back and render lines that you missed. And so it is known that PNG, due to its two-dimensional interlacing, gives you a perception of a partial image before you see the entire image, and the refinement seems more continuous and gradual as opposed to the abrupt updation that GIF does. The last advantage is compression that is achieved. PNG's compression is more along the lines of JPEG, and therefore you get almost 25 to 25% better compression than GIF, which, by the way, uses a compression that's only based on text compression and not on image fundamentals. The other important features of PNG are that it supports 3 main types of images, image types. It supports true color, grayscale, palette-based, which is also what we looked at as lookup table-based or 8-bit lookup table-based. Compare this to JPEG, which only supports true color and grayscale, and GIF that only supports a palette-based lookup table type image. One significant shortcoming of PNG, at least as it stands today, is the fact that it doesn't provide animation. There have been movements among the group to support a version of PNG that's going to involve animation. Let's try to understand what color means in both images and video. Color, as we see in nature, arises from the concept of light. That is, light, as we see it, visible light is an electromagnetic wave in the range of 400 nanometers to 700 nanometers. That's the wavelength of these waves. The entire electromagnetic spectrum spans the range of wavelengths. However, visible light, that is what we perceive, what we can see, is limited to this particular range. Of course, we have ultraviolet and infrared, which we don't really consider to be visible light, but the effects can be perceived. Similarly, X-rays are rays that we cannot see, but their effects can be perceived, and so are gamma rays. Similarly, on the low end of the spectrum, we have radio waves, which further down tend to come all the way to sound waves, which we can hear but we cannot see, and we can only perceive them as sound. Most light we see is not of one wavelength. That is, whenever we look at light and say, oh, it is of certain color, it might be of a certain color, but it in reality it comprises a waves of many wavelengths. For example, we see that at any point, any given piece of light, I am probably using the word piece very loosely here, but we can take an example of a light source which actually contains or comprises of all the wavelengths of the visible spectrum from 400 nanometers to 700 nanometers. And I'm just showing you an example where their relative amplitudes have been given to show that this particular source of light has these these wavelengths in these ratios or with this intensity. Now that we understand what light is and the fact that it comprises of several wavelengths, let's try to understand how humans perceive light or how humans perceive color or whatever we call as images that we perceive on our eyes. The eye functions on the same principle as a camera. That is, each neuron is either a rod or a cone, and these rods and cones have special purpose in the sense that a rod contains elements that are sensitive to light intensities. That is, they're sensitive to brightness. Whereas cones are more sensitive to color. What we see here is that cones actually being sensitive to color come in three types. That is, we have cones that predominantly react to red light, cones that react to green light, and cones that react to blue light. The figure that you see ahead of you shows how humans are sensitive to these various colors. And notice that the human eye is sensitivity to various colors is different. That is, we are more sensitive to green than we are to blue. We're actually sensitive to red more than we are to blue also. And we also see from this figure that we are more sensitive to brightness or luminosity than we are to the color. This fact has very important ramifications when we try to use it in compression of images. Let's take this treatment one step further and try to understand what exactly humans perceive eventually. That is, when the brain registers this image that it is looking at, how does it respond to it, or how does it register it in terms of the signals that it receives? The cones provide humans with vision during the daylight and are believed to be separated into three types, as I said before, where each type is more sensitive to a particular wavelength. As a matter of fact, it's believed that at night times our cones really don't play any role because they really react to brightness and darkness, and that's all we really perceive. We don't really perceive color as much as we perceive the brightness and the lack of it, which is darkness. The color signal that the brain receives comes from the response of the three cones to the spectra being observed. That is, the signal that it receives has three numbers or three components. Let's say we have light that is incident on this entity that you're trying to perceive. Let's call that E, which is light, and light contains several components or several wavelengths. So let's say one of the wavelengths is E of lambda. That's a function that captures that particular wavelength of light. Now, when this particular component of wavelength is perceived by the eye, it sends a signal to the brain, and this signal is a combination of the light intensity, that is E lambda, a function of E lambda, and the sensitivity of the human eye to that particular component, that is the red component. So we say that the red value that is received by the eye is E lambda times SR of lambda d lambda. That is, it's taken, we take this integral over the entire wavelengths from 400 nanometers all the way to 700 nanometers. So to give you an idea how this really fits in, there are probably some wavelengths that have no value whatsoever. So those don't contribute, because when you multiply this with the sensitivity of the human eye to that particular component, then it probably amounts to zero. Whereas there are other frequencies which have a significant value, and if the human eye was very sensitive to that particular component, then it would register. So you could have a case where there is a component, frequency or wavelength component, which is pretty high or pretty significant, but the human eye cannot perceive it, which means that the sensitivity of the human eye is almost zero to that particular component, and so it would contribute a red value, or whatever that value is, the contribution would be zero. So it's a combination of both the component and the sensitivity of the human eye that together determine what we receive as signals to the brain. Just to take this treatment even further, let's say a person is colorblind. Well, what do we mean by that? Well, it really means that his or her sensitivity to certain colors is either absent or is different from the normal human sensitivity. So what we have here is this person is not sensitive to certain colors, and so when the person perceives images, those components which he or she is not sensitive to tend to not register in the brain, and that's why they would see only certain colors and they wouldn't see other colors prominently. One thing also to notice is that the sensitivity function, where we represent that by SR lambda, SG lambda, and SB lambda, these might be different for different animals. For example, most humans will probably have the same function with a slight difference, but different animals might have different sensitivity to various colors. Let's look at the various components and how they contribute to make up various wavelengths that constitutes the visible light. We're asking the question, what is the composition of the various wavelengths in terms of the three components, red, blue, and green? As the figure shows, we notice that different wavelengths, for example, a wavelength of 400 nanometers is almost all blue light, and there is even that the blue content is very, very minimal. Let's move further through the spectrum, and we notice that value of wavelength around 520 or 550 is going to have a combination of both green, red, and some blue, and that's what comprises that particular wavelength. And I want to make a note that this figure that you see is different from the human perception or sensitivity of light. What we mean by that is, this is simply telling you, if you have a light of frequency 500 nanometers, all it's answering is, what does this contain? How much blue does it have? How much green does it have? And how much red does it have? Whereas the sensitivity is telling us, as humans perceive, how much of that red or how much of that green or how much of that blue are we capable of perceiving as humans. Let's take a look at the color models that are used in images. We've looked at the terms red, green, and blue, or in other words, the components of light that have the colors red, green and blue. Now, it turns out that there are two popular models that are used. One is an RGB model, which is what we call as an additive model, and the CMY model, which is a subtractive model. The CMY model stands for cyan, magenta, and yellow, and obviously the RGB model is red, green, and blue. The RGB model is used in cathode ray tube displays or monitors, and the idea here is that the monitor has phosphors which have this property of being when they impinged with a certain frequency or voltage of light, they absorb certain light and then they glow with a certain color for a small amount of time. So displaying an image or displaying any content on a monitor involves projecting the right amount of light or the right voltage on these phosphors in order to make them display a particular color. In that sense, a color image is just a two-dimensional array of the RGB values that need to represent that particular phosphor that is being displayed. Let's contrast this with the CMY model, which is a subtractive model. The CMY model uses complementary colors, which are cyan, magenta, and yellow, which are complementary to red, green, and blue. As you see in the figure, the opposite of cyan on the cube is red, and the opposite of magenta is green, and the opposite of blue is yellow. The CMY model is used primarily on printing devices where we have color pigments on the paper that tend to absorb certain colors when we spray ink on them. And that's the idea that is used. That is, when we spray cyan ink on some of these pigments, cyan ink, no red light is reflected from cyan ink. That is, what we have as a result is that when light falls on this on the printed paper and we perceive it, one of the things that happens is when red light, the light that you have has the entire visible spectrum in it, and when white light falls on this image which is on the paper, it the particular pigment on one of the spots is going to absorb part of it and it's going to reflect rest of the light. So when we would like it to absorb a certain color, we simply spray the complementary color there. So in order for it to absorb red light, we would use cyan ink in the spot, and so it would absorb red light, but it would reflect everything else, and that's what gives you the color on that particular location on the paper. Unlike images, video uses a different color model. As a matter of fact, there are three popular color models that are used in video. One is called YUV, the other is called YIQ, and the third is a modification of YUV, and it's called YCBCR. The YUV model was used primarily in the PAL format, which was popular in Europe, and the YIQ color model was used in the NTSC format, which is used popularly in the United States and some Western European countries. The human perception is, as we saw before in the sensitivity graph, is more sensitive to luminance or brightness than it is to chrominance or color. What that translates to is that since we are more sensitive to brightness, let's try to extract, instead of extracting the color red, blue, and green, let's try to extract the brightness component of a given pixel and give more importance to the brightness component simply because the human eye is more sensitive to the brightness component. So we can do this by observing or by an empirical mechanism that they've devised where we say that the luminance component, here we represent that by Y, in the case of YUV model, can be extracted as being a combination of the red, green, and blue, and the combination is 0.299R plus 0.587G plus 0.114B together gives us the Y component, which is the brightness or the luminance. Notice that these simply say that the ratio or the weight for each of those components adds up to 1, which means that we have the brightness, which is nothing but a combination of some contribution from R, some contribution from G, and some contribution from B. As it turns out, the contribution is primarily from G and less from R and even less from B. Now, chrominance, which is a color component, is defined as a difference between a color and the reference white at the same luminance. This was just a convenience that they used, had no significance whatsoever from human perception point of view. Accordingly, we define U to be whatever the B component value is minus Y, and V to be whatever the red component value is minus Y. If you're wondering what happened to the green, well, the green has contributed significantly to the luminance, and both U and V actually do have a green as a part of them, because U is really B minus Y, and Y turns out to be a combination of red, green, and blue. As I said before, the eye is most sensitive to Y. Therefore, any error in the resolution of the Y component is more important than the U and V values. In order to accommodate this fact, in the PAL format, what they've done is they've given higher bandwidth allocation for the Y component. That is, they have 5 megahertz bandwidth for the Y component, 1.3 megahertz for U, and the same 1.3 megahertz for V. Other formats, digital formats that have come to use the PAL color model or the YUV color model are CDI and DVI that are used extensively in computer video. Let's now take a look at the YIQ model. Well, as we said, although U and V are just convenient terminologies in the case of the YUV model, they don't have any perceptional quality. That is, they don't represent any human perception or towards color sensitivity. Hence, we look at this alternative representation where I and Q are actually sensitive, or they've been derived taking into account the human sensitivity to the various colors. Accordingly, I and Q are defined as being I is equal to 0.596R minus 0.275G minus 0.321B, and Q is 0.212R minus 0.523G plus 0.311B. The important fact to remember about the YIQ model is that since our I and Q components are not just some convenient measures, but they actually have a significance in terms of human sensitivity. What they've done in NTSC format, broadcast of TV, is that they've assigned 4.2 megahertz for Y, 1.5 megahertz to I, and 0.55 megahertz to Q. Obviously, this gives us greater flexibility and tolerance to loss than it does in the YUV model, because the YUV model gives equal importance to both U and V, and if we're starved for bandwidth, we don't know which to sacrifice. Whereas in the case of the YIQ model, we can clearly say that if we are constrained for bandwidth, then we always have try and give more importance to Y, second most importance to I, and the least importance to the Q component. There's one other color model that is used, as I mentioned before, called the YCBCR color model. This is closely related to YUV, except that the way U and V have been defined in the YUV model, there's a possibility that these values can be greater than 1 or even less than 0. This can cause some confusion in terms of computations. Therefore, this YCBCR model does some scaling and shifting to make sure that the values CB and CR, which are derived very similar to the U and V in the YUV model, are always within the limits of 0 and 1. By the way, YCBCR model is used both in JPEG and MPEG. So let's summarize what we've studied in this lesson. We've looked at the fact that color images are encoded or represented as triplets of values where each triplet represents one pixel. An RGB model is an additive color model that is used for light-emitting devices like monitors, which contain phosphors, and a phosphor is a light-emitting device. Whereas CMY is a subtractive model that is used often for printers, which actually print on papers, and the papers tend to absorb light rather than emit light. Sometimes we use an alternative mechanism, color model, which we haven't talked about so far, which is called the CMYK model. The problem with the CMY model is that it doesn't have the black in the CMY model tends to be not black enough. So one of the things that we do with the CMYK model is we use K to represent what the absolute black is, and then to produce darker black than simply mixing CMY, we say K is given by the minimum of CMY, and C is given by C minus K, M is given by M minus K, and Y is given by Y minus K. To understand the significance of this model, what we observe is that by normalizing the values of CMY, by taking the minimum of them to be the minimum value among the entire picture to be the baseline K, we've essentially made our blacks blacker or darker and given more quality to the image. And this is particularly useful in color printing because it tends to be very difficult to get really dark blacks in color images if you just combine C, M, and Y. Two common models in imaging were looked at, which are RGB and CMY. We also looked at two common color models in video, YIQ and YUV. We also looked at a modification of YUV, which is this YCBCR. And lastly, we looked at how humans are sensitive to certain colors. They're sensitive to light more than they're sensitive to color. And these facts formed a basis for some of the color models that have been devised in the literature.